that was like about 2 months into teaching.
Mm-hmm. There's a theory that you can judge how good a teacher you are by how many times you get fired from your job. So,
yeah. So where did you go to?
Where did I go to elementary
what
school?
What did you?
All right. So I went to elementary school in San Francisco. And I went to a bunch of them because they had just started busing. And we were some of the only registered native kids in San Francisco. So they sent me to a different school almost every year, which will wreck you for social anything. So I went to Alvarado, at the time what was Douglas and became Harvey Milk, Marshall Annex, Edison, Star King. And the school that I first taught at was Alvarado School. I taught a crochet class when I was in third grade. And then I taught at Alvarado School much later.
You taught the class when you were in third grade?
Yeah, I did. Mm-hmm. And then, I don't know, I've been teaching my whole life. It's sort of a habit. It's a bad habit. And I've been fired from jobs a lot. They neglected to rehire me from my last university position, where I am not teaching now, but they still have on their website that you can come study with me if you go there. So, they only fired part of me. They like the title.
Which really, part did they fire?
They fired the person, but they really liked the title, so they kept that.
So they kept the title.
Yeah.
And again, excerpts from an event that happened recently in the Bay Area celebrating our very own Dennis Bernstein's latest book, Five Oceans in a Teaspoon. And that does it for today's program.
And you are listening to KBOO Portland. Coming up next, Sprouts.
Welcome to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program that showcases radio production by independent community radio. We bring local stories to a national audience, produced at a different location every week. I'm Sarah McConnell of With Good Reason, produced by Virginia Humanities. Today on Sprouts, gerrymandering and redistricting reform.
Just change the boundary, redraw the line. Vote the wrong way every time, but move the borders and we will dominate. First take away the people's choice and then we'll rule the state.
Politicians from John F. Kennedy to Ronald Reagan have called gerrymandering a cancer on our democracy. Our first guest is Michael Gilbert from the University of Virginia School of Law. He says gerrymandering is unpopular for a number of reasons.
Gerrymandering makes people mad because it seems in at least two ways to run contrary to what democracy is supposed to be about. And I think the first way is that it produces, or at least it can produce, disproportionate outcomes. So I'll give you a couple of examples, one of which we might come back to. North Carolina. Over the last, say, 6 or 8 years, Republicans statewide in North Carolina have commanded about 50 to 55% of the statewide vote share, and they're getting 10 of the state's 13 congressional districts. So both sides do it, disproportionality results, and that just seems fundamentally anti-democratic. There's a second reason, too, that I think relates in a way to the first and that makes people angry. Gerrymandering sometimes reduces competitiveness. So as a consequence of manipulating the district lines, you might have an incumbent in office whose party makes up 70 or 80% of the vote share in that district, and that incumbent doesn't effectively face competition in the general election. And so if you're in the minority in that district, you feel like you have no voice, you feel like your vote is diluted, and you feel like this representative can more or less do whatever he or she wants, and they're going to get reelected.
Conversely, what would happen if you had more fair reapportionment of the lines? You might have a district that's more evenly stacked with voters on both parties, and therefore the politician's going to listen.
Well, that's the theory. If you have a 80 to 20 district, say, the 20% Democrats or Republicans, whoever happens to be in the minority in that district, the incumbent who represents the district doesn't have much reason to listen to them or to pay attention to them. Whereas if you have a 50-50 district, you got to secure your base and also get some votes from the other side, which means you have to listen to both sides. You have to govern in a different kind of way.
So redistricting itself, not gerrymandering, but redistricting is mandated in the Constitution?
That's correct. So the U.S. Constitution requires the federal government to run a census every 10 years. And the purpose of the census, the principal purpose in the Constitution, is to apportion seats in the U.S. House of Representatives. So you have to know each state's population to figure out how many seats they get. Okay, now we have some more constitutional layers on top of this. Once you know how many seats your state gets, you have to divide the state into an appropriate number of districts. And according to the Supreme Court, the Constitution requires you, when doing so, to have about the same number of people in each district. So this is part of the reason that we now have to draw the lines every 10 years, because every 10 years people have moved around. So whereas the lines, when they were drawn, you might have an equal number of people, more or less, across them, 10 years on, there are big discrepancies. And the Constitution tells us, okay, we have to redraw the lines, we have to equalize the populations.
Give me an example of how it typically goes down.
So it's a little hard to generalize, but I'll take a stab. After the census, each state gets the information from the federal government telling them, more or less, who lives where, how many people. And then with that information in hand, the legislature, or a committee in the legislature, goes about drawing some potential district lines, and they might hear from other politicians, and they might hear from some engaged groups in the community, the state. They almost certainly, in this day and age, they have experts in the room with line drawing and mapping software, and they work through various iterations of their plan. And at some point, they come up with one that they agree on. And it goes to the full legislature for a vote. So what's putting the lines in place is it's effectively a statute that gets enacted by the legislature and then, depending on the exact rules in your state, signed into law by the governor, and it has the force of law for the next 10 years.
What does it seem in the last 20 years or so? There's been more outrage over how these legislatures have conducted gerrymandering.
I think part of the story has to do with visibility. I don't know to what extent it's social media, the digital age, but people are just more aware that this is happening now than they used to be. But there's something else going on, too. Technology has improved, and legislators are better at gerrymandering than ever before. So a kind of notorious case that people are discussing these days is North Carolina. The statistics run like this. The state is just over half Republican, but Republicans are winning 10 out of 13 congressional seats there consistently. When a member of the legislature there, who is a Republican and who played a key role in drawing those district lines, was asked why the map is 10 to 3 in favor of Republicans, his answer on the record was, "I couldn't find any way to make it 11 to 2 in favor of Republicans." So that's gerrymandering that benefits Republicans, and that statement and just owning up to it, that made a lot of people mad.
However, courts have struck down what is called racial gerrymandering?
Correct. So just as you can draw the lines with an eye towards, say, disadvantaging Democrats or Republicans, whoever your political opponent is, you can also draw the lines with a focus on race instead of partisanship. We're going to move, for example, these African-American voters into that district over there and move these white voters over here. That, the courts have been very clear, you cannot do. When you manipulate the lines on the basis of race, you run afoul of the Equal Protection Clause in the 14th Amendment.
So which states recently have tried to overturn their system and go to something more equitable?
There are a number of examples across the country. I can mention two for you now, Arizona and California. They have both, in the last 20 years, more recently in California, used direct democracy to bypass the legislature and create a new districting commission that operates really outside of the legislature's control. And there are lots of institutional details here, but the short version is we're trying to take it away from the legislature and give it to a group of citizens, and we're going to give them information, and we're going to tell them not to focus on politics, and we're going to try to remove some of this taint from the process.
There are other states that have opted for reform of this process.
That's correct. There are lots of states that try different systems, and I don't think there is any kind of best practice emerging at this point. I'll just give you one other example. Iowa has a longstanding and, as far as I know, unique process. The legislature, in fact, votes on the lines, but the maps are produced by a set of nonpartisan officials inside the legislature who, when they draw the maps, among other things, are not given information about the political leanings of voters or even the addresses of incumbents in the legislature. So, among other things, they can draw district lines that move an incumbent from inside her district to outside of it. Then these maps are proposed to the state legislature. The legislature gets a vote, but it's up or down. They don't have a chance to amend it, and the thinking is that saps some of the politics from it. So, for people who are interested in changing the method by which district lines get drawn, one seemingly promising approach was to challenge district lines in court, and specifically federal court. There's been litigation about this, lots of it recently, where the claim is that having the legislatures draw the lines and specifically producing a map like the one in North Carolina, the one in Maryland, that violates the federal constitution. And we want the courts to come in and say, you can't do that. And in the process, have those courts sort of structure this process in a way going forward, providing guidelines to legislatures that makes them do this in a fairer way. That approach has failed. And it has failed because the Supreme Court has told us in a very recent opinion that the federal courts are closed for business. They can't hear these kinds of claims.
So what if I'm saying to the court, here's an example of what I think should not be constitutional, that I have a state with roughly 50-50 party affiliation, and I, the slightly dominant party, have come up with with a vast majority of the congressional seats.
So this is exactly the kind of claim that was brought to the Supreme Court recently. The court, even the majority of the court that wrote the opinion, they're sympathetic to the claim that something seems amiss here, but their challenge is to find out how to evaluate that. What would a fair map or a constitutional map look like? And it turns out it's really hard to tell. So let me just give you a simple example that will maybe help us think about the challenge. Suppose you have a state that has 200 people only, to make it easy, in it. And 100 of them are Republicans, and 100 of them are Democrats, and you need two districts, each with 100 people. So one natural way to do it is to create one district with 100 Republicans and one district with 100 Democrats. Well, the second you do this, you're going to make a lot of people mad because you've sapped away all political competition. If you're in the Republican district and you're even thinking of leaning left, well, your vote is completely diluted. You have no say here. And likewise, if you're on the other side. So we lose the political competition that is not just good policy, but which we might think is central to the very democracy that the Constitution is supposed to produce. So you don't want to do 100 and 100. Here's the other natural way to do it. You make each of the two districts 50-50. But there's a problem. First of all, two 50-50 districts are in no way guaranteed to produce a legislature with one Republican and one Democrat. you could, with just the slightest wave, either way, get two Democrats or two Republicans. So now you have your disproportionality problem again. There's a second dilemma, too, which is when you draw a 50-50 district, you are drawing a district in which you know that about half the population is going to be unhappy with the election. And in a country, in a democracy that's trying to promote good representation, that's a kind of funny way to do it. So that's why I say there are these competing values at stake. No matter which way you draw the lines, you're either bumping up against competition or proportionality or just a sense of good representation. And this is what motivated the court to say, the door's closed, we don't know how to do it.
Michael Gilbert teaches law at the University of Virginia School of Law. You're listening to Sprouts, Radio from the Grassroots, a weekly program bringing you local radio productions of national interest. I'm Sarah McConnell of With Good Reason, produced in Charlottesville, Virginia. Coming up next, after the November elections, we may be seeing a political realignment. Since 2016, states like Pennsylvania and Ohio have made news for turning toward the Republican Party. Democrats, meanwhile, see hope in traditionally red southern states that have been turning blue. Quentin Kidd is a political scientist at Christopher Newport University. He's written about political realignments in history and says we're seeing something similar today. Quentin, last month, Democrats in Virginia took control of both houses in the General Assembly, and they have a Democratic governor. Is this what we call Trump effect voting on the part of Virginians in the last election? Or has there been a migration from more liberal northern states and northern Virginia to influence the electorate?
The answer is yes on both of those parts. There has been a migration into Virginia of people from many other states, Northeast being among the larger regions of the country to give Virginia residents. Northern Virginia right now, which is sort of all of that area that is that right up against Washington, D.C., it's about 3 million people. More than 50% of them are not from Virginia. And nearly 50% of Hampton Roads, which is in the Norfolk area where all the naval and military bases are, about 50% of them are not from Virginia. So Virginia, the two largest metropolitan areas in Virginia right now, are dominated by residents that don't have historical ties to Virginia through family. They're not born here. They've moved here for some reason. And so they have brought their politics to the state with them. And those politics tend to be a little bit more liberal than Virginia was prior to them coming. However, we see strong evidence of a Trump effect, and we see that in increased voter turnout. For example, in the last election that was like this current election that we just had, which is that both houses of the legislature were up, the Senate and the House of Delegates, 4 years ago, turnout was 28, almost 29%. This year, turnout is going to be 43% or so. And there were some districts, some election districts this year that had turnout that approached presidential level turnout. That is the Trump effect. Those voters that were engaged and energized as a result of 2016 and are voting because of that are voting Democratic. They're not voting Republican. And so that's why you've seen in the last two election cycles, Democrats have picked up 21 seats from Republicans in the House of Delegates. So they've really benefited from Donald Trump. I sort of characterize Virginia politics and Virginia elections right now as one where there's a steady wind that blows from the north, and that wind is Donald Trump. And I think that's true in a lot of other states, not just Virginia.
You know, Virginia Republicans were gleeful last winter when there was scandal in the state house and several top Democrats were accused of having worn blackface when they were younger. And Republicans said this is going to doom Democrats at the polls in November, and they will lose their African-American base. That didn't happen.
No, it did not happen. It did hurt the governor, Governor Ralph Northam, for a while, but a couple of things saved Democrats, if you will. One, younger voters Those are voters under 40, whether black or white, didn't like the blackface scandal, and they did pull away from Ralph Northam in terms of their support. However, older African Americans, those older than 45, never really abandoned Governor Northam. And so while his approval ratings did drop pretty dramatically into the low 40% in our own polling, the drop was because younger voters, millennial voters, really found blackface to be distasteful and really rejected it. And as a result of that, you know, when the governor disappeared from the campaign trail and focused on governing instead of campaigning, it didn't hurt Democratic candidates on the campaign trail as much because their African-American base was still with them. Remember, in state legislative elections, you know, voter turnout is typically half of what it is in a presidential year election. And the voters that typically pull away and don't vote in state legislative elections are younger voters. So the very voters that didn't like blackface the most are the very voters that are least likely to vote anyway in a state legislative election.
For years, the legislature in Virginia was very much male-dominated. There were very few women. And yet there was a surge of women who came into office in the Virginia legislature 2 years ago. And this year, more women ran as Democrats than men for the first time in Virginia history. And Virginia has its first ever woman Speaker of the House. How much did women voters, do you think, play a role in the election?
So I think women in particular are the reason Democrats are in the position that they're in right now. After the election of Donald Trump in 2016, almost immediately, within days, I started getting emails from groups that eventually became known as Indivisible or Resistance, the Peninsula Resistance, the Hampton Roads Resistance. One of them called the Liberal Women of Chesterfield County, which is a suburban county south of Richmond. These groups popped up within days of the election of Donald Trump, and they became mobilized, they became energized, and they never really stopped being mobilized and energized. They carried that energy and that mobilization into the 2017 state legislative races where Democrats picked up 15 seats from Republicans. Many of those women, the first transgender woman elected to the Virginia legislature, they carried that momentum, that energy into the 2018 midterm elections where Democrats picked up 3 congressional seats from Republicans. All 3 women won those seats. And 2 of those 3 women had never run for political office before. That was a characteristic of a lot of the women candidates, is that they didn't have prior political experience, which means they were energized by the election of Donald Trump. And then in this 2019 legislative races, I think women also carried the day. There was one particular race that I find interesting because it fits a lot of interesting storylines, and that is there's a state Senate district just south and west of Richmond, you know, that is relatively rural in most parts of it, even though another part of the district is in a pretty urban suburban area. It just elected the first Muslim woman in Virginia. So we have a Muslim woman who will join the Virginia State Senate. Her name is Ghazala Hashmi. If you had told me 5 or 6 years ago that this district would elect a Muslim woman, I would have told you that I'm not sure that we're talking about the same Virginia. That's how rapid this change has been in Virginia.
You wrote a book about how the southern states in America changed from majority Democrat to majority Republicans. Over what era was that?
It was basically from the 1950s through the early 1990s.
How former conservative Democratic politicians in the South left the party and became Republicans. Do you think we're about to see another national realignment of the two parties? Where do the moderates live in the future?
What seems to be happening in some states in the South and in some Midwestern states is that older generations of conservative voters are giving way to younger voters that aren't as conservative, their sons and daughters and perhaps grandchildren, and new voters, immigrants or migrants. that's the story of Virginia's transition politically. It's the story of what's going on in North Carolina. The triangle area of North Carolina is to North Carolina what Northern Virginia is to Virginia. It's this growing region that has people from all over the country and the world moving there to work, and their politics look very different from North Carolina's politics, and they're ultimately driving some change in North Carolina that might not be where Virginia is right now, but it's probably not far behind. That's the story of Atlanta, where the suburbs of Atlanta are booming, people moving there from all over the world, and in fact, sort of a reverse migration where African Americans who two or three generations ago maybe left the South for Chicago or Detroit or other large northern cities, their children and grandchildren now coming back to the South, and a lot of them are coming back to Atlanta. So it's sort of Atlanta's going through this, you know, renaissance period in some ways, and what's going on in Atlanta is driving change in Georgia. So that's what's driving change in those southern states, and then in Midwestern states you have older unionized workers who whose economies have left them, essentially the auto industry and the steel industry, and they're giving way to younger workers who are having to find ways to make a living in this new economy that where there's not the guarantees of a union and union wages and all that. And so their politics are changing also. And in those states, you have people leaving because their economies aren't so great and they're seeking work in other places. And it's changing the politics of those states. And in some ways, these trends are going in the reverse direction. So an Ohio, a Pennsylvania, Wisconsin, used to be very blue states, are now trending purplish and red. And states like Virginia, North Carolina, Georgia, used to be reliably red states, are trending blue and purple. And so there is this kind of realignment going on. And then out west, you know, places like Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, it's the story of in-migration. Latino populations that are burgeoning, people moving out of California into Arizona, Nevada, Colorado, and it's changing the politics of those states as well. So there's a lot of realignment going on in the country, and it isn't clear to me, as I sit here right now, whether at the end of the day that results in a strong Republican majority, a strong Democratic majority, or both parties, both coalitions, kind of equally incised, and so you know, the sort of political fights that we've been having continue.
So it's not like water seeking its level. It's not that always the parties will find that moderates and progressives and the right wing and the left wing eventually sort of settle out.
Eventually, yes. But, you know, as this plays out, like, you know, do the moderates find their place only to discover that their place is moving even as they found it? And I think that is part of what happens a lot of times. Let's just take, you know, the Republican Party from 1980 to present, right? So in 1980, Ronald Reagan is elected president, and that's the culmination of those conservative whites who used to be Democrats in the South moving to the Republican coalition. It's the culmination of what we came to call the moral majority, the evangelical vote moving to the Republican coalition and away from Democrats. And so in the early 1980s, the Reagan Republicans, the Reagan Democrats, were very conservative. They were what you would call movement Republicans. They were the sort of conservative base of the Republican Party. Once Newt Gingrich took over as Speaker of the House of Representatives, we can look back on this and realize that Newt Gingrich ushered in a new energy in the Republican coalition that resulted ultimately in the Tea Party and resulted ultimately in the Trump coalition of voters. So that now what is or was a Reagan Republican doesn't really find themselves a home in the Republican Party. I was talking to somebody who was the classic Reagan Republican. She had worked in the Reagan White House. She was involved in Republican politics pretty actively. And she says, I just don't have a home in the Republican Party right now. There's no place for a Republican like me. And I can remember when the Republican base was the Reagan Republicans. And so, you know, when a moderate finds a place in a party, it could very well be that that place is in fact moving as they've found it.
Quentin Kidd, thank you for sharing your insights. This is fascinating.
You're more than welcome. Glad to be with you.
Quentin Kidd is a professor of political science at Christopher Newport University.
We got kind of nervous as we read the polling news, 'cause we sure need our paychecks and the perks and titles.
You're listening to an episode of Sprouts. The time is 11:29, and this is KBOO Portland.
Join KBOO by December 31st and receive free gifts and prizes from the Give Guide. Just click the donate banner on the KBOO app to keep community radio strong and vibrant in Portland and beyond.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Portland's Folk Festival on Friday, January 10th and Saturday, January 11th, 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom in Portland. Portland's Folk Festival is an all-ages celebration of folk and Americana music in Portland. Friday performers include Anna Tivol, Cedar Tea, Glitter Fox, and more. Saturday performers include Horse Feathers, The Get Ahead, and more. Again, that's Portland's Folk Festival, Friday, January 10th, and Saturday, January 11th, from 6 to midnight at the Crystal Ballroom, 1332 West Burnside Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
When we meet, there won't be winter.
Coming up next, WINGS, the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Today, from the WINGS Archive, the political, spiritual life of Marta Benavides.
Anybody in the community, if they have problems, they will come to her. And since I was the oldest, I was always caring with her, with the people that came for support.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings.
Welcome to WINGS, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hi, this is Frida Worden, producer of WINGS. For years, during the war in El Salvador, WINGS received a newsletter from someone named Marta Benavides. We never knew who she was or even where she was. Her mailings had return addresses from churches in the U.S. Finally, in October 1996, Marta Benavides came to Texas to address the Foundation for a Compassionate Society's Forum on Feminism and Fundamentalism. I learned she is a Baptist minister, yet she was an aide to the martyred Catholic Archbishop of El Salvador, Oscar Romero. On the local cable TV program Women's News Hour, I got to ask her more questions.
What I'm dying to ask you about is who you are, how did you get that way, you know, and why do you stand for the things that you do, kind of like the adventure of your life?
It's really an adventure, and I have had a lot of fun. And there are times that it has been quite difficult, and I question, oh, why this, why the other? But in general, it has been a very, very meaningful way of living. I was born in El Salvador and raised in El Salvador. My mother is a mountain woman, and my father is a bureaucrat. Both of them taught me things which were very, very important in my life. My mother taught me a lot about nature. You know, to see nature with awe and to respect it and love it and care for nature, you know. And my father taught me a lot about geography, which is another way also about knowing about nature. But he was telling me about my country, and he would put the map, and when I was very young, he was telling me about little towns all over and telling me about the problems and about what they grow here and all kinds of things, history. And one thing that I learned also with my mother is natural medicine and medicinal plants, and about how hard the people work in El Salvador. And you know, my mother always was rebellious about things. People had to work too hard for what they had, and she never liked it. Mm-hmm. And I saw it too, and I said, I don't like it either. I want the different, you know, always respect the people who are poor. And then my mother said, they are not poor, it's just that people have made them poor. And so many times, you know, that overwhelms you. And so that was a great, great lesson. And she was the person that anybody in the community, if they had problems, they would come to her. And since I was the oldest, you know, I was always caring with her, with the people that came for support. And it didn't matter what kind of thing. It could be that somebody was trying to commit suicide, so they would go and look for my mother and, you know, can you do something about it? So wow. I would go with my mother, you know, mm-hmm. climb through the windows and all that to try to talk with the people.
Wow.
Or console the persons that were involved in the situation, things like that. So those things really affected me. And it gave me a lot of chance to see life.
And so you became a Baptist minister, right?
Yeah, but it wasn't a planned thing, you know. What happened is that my family is all Catholic and, you know, Protestants proselytize in my country. And I, in a sense, fitted what people think is a good Protestant, you know, because, you know, the Protestant work ethic. I was a very good student. And so, you know, so they went after me and invited me to church and my parents let me go. And when I became a Protestant, like about 8 or 9 years old.
Wow.
They respected. What happens is that the Protestant church, you know, they didn't respect that my parents were Catholic.
Oh.
Because there is no respect, you know, when you think that you must turn from here to this, it's because this is bad and this is good. So I think the message that Christ gave for me is very important. I could understand and agree with that, you know, but I couldn't understand how the church behaved. So I went to study theology. After I got my degree in biology, I went and studied theology because I was going to be a doctor. But then I decided to go and work in a hospital just to see how it worked.
Mm-hmm.
And I saw that that's a rat race there, that nobody really wants to take care of people and it's about pushing a lot of things, you know, especially pills on people and bunches of them. And so when I was studying biology, I spent some vacations working at the hospital and I found out that, you know, that's not what I wanted. I wanted to be about health and healing, which is wholeness. You know, health, healing and wholeness are coming from the same roots, but curing is not. It's curing is different. You know, it's not about wholeness. It's about dealing with this particular illness. But in the healing and in the wholeness, health is global. And so I realized, well, I didn't understand it as clearly as I understand it now, but I knew that I didn't want to be a doctor taking care of people that were not taught how to take care of themselves, and so you have to help them to put up with life, you know, mend them in a sense.
Ah.
So that's why I went to theology.
The spiritual side instead of just the physical side.
But mostly because I wanted to know how come the church, having all the resources it has, it doesn't work for healing and for wholeness, but a lot of time creates a lot of the illness. Participates with that. For example, at home, the churches were very much involved in maintaining a system that has not been about affirmative of life, of people and planet. And so that's why I went. But once I got my training, I wasn't going to really go and work for the church. That wasn't my purpose because I never went to school to get a degree so I can get a better paying job. I always went to school because I wanted to know. I wanted to become a person, a wholeness in that too, you know.
Did you have a hard time in theological seminary?
It was kind of difficult. You know, just to express these things, to say, I hear the message of Christ, but I don't hear the Christian church giving and practicing that message.
Mm-hmm.
And it doesn't even make it easy for anybody to do it. They say, you're socialist, you're communist. And they started to attack me. So it was mostly men. There were not too many women either.
I wondered about
but
that.
The women that were there, they wanted to do Christian education. And I didn't want to do Christian education. I wanted to develop the principles of how the church work. I wanted to work with missions because they were sending missionaries into our countries. So I did a lot of research and studied missiology, you know, mission ways. And but I became ordained because of Monsignor Romero.
Oh, you worked with the Archbishop in El Salvador.
Yeah.
But he's a Catholic. You became ordained as a Baptist? Or?
Because he asked me. And that was really good, you know, because
he asked you to become ordained as a Baptist.
No, he said, basically, you know, like, we were good friends, and I was ready to go and do whatever we needed, because that was right before the war started. So I told him always, whatever I can do, I will.
Mm-hmm.
So just let me know. And he says, come. And, you know, we were sponsoring this ecumenical committee for humanitarian aid nationwide because many people were being repressed and families were being destroyed and people were being disappeared. So we were going to do this kind of work. So he was starting that and he wanted me to run it. And so this was not a paid job, just like, let's do this together, you know? Mm-hmm. And so I said, yeah, I'll do it. And he says, when? Whenever. Well, now, he said. Oh, okay. I said, so I stopped everything I was doing and I went and did these things with him. But he said to me, he called me daughter. Mm-hmm. He said, hija, are you ordained? And I was so happy to say, no, I am not, you know, I'm not so happy. Like, nobody can really, you know, control this.
Yes.
And he says, you know, he made a play on words. To be ordained in Spanish, you have to say, it means order, ordenación. So he say, you must become in order.
Uh-huh.
You must, you know, tú tienes que ordenarte.
Yes. Uh-huh.
Because out of order, porque desordenada no me sirves. You're no good to me. Uh-huh. You're out of order. Uh-huh. And I say, I look at him. I used to call him Monse. Uh-huh. I say, Monse, you're kidding, right? You're kidding. He said, no. They will never ordain me. Because I am not into making, you know, a power out of the church, but to get the church to work with us and exercising the power that we are. And he says, no, you must get ordained. And I was the first woman to become ordained, the first woman ordained in El Salvador. But, you know, after his death, I realized that, you know, what an important thing to do, to have a woman working in the same capabilities as ministers together, you know, ministering to the whole country, bringing churches together.
It made you his peer.
Exactly.
That you were ordained.
Uh-huh. And also, it was a statement of what he thought of women ordination. It's really amazing, you know? And mm-hmm. unity.
Mm-hmm.
He always talked of unity in his sermons, in his homilies. He always talked about unity, that people must get together, and together you can do the things that you need to. Together you must ask of your organizations to have a program that really is responsive to the needs of the people, not something that they are trying to tell you what to do. People who are in organizations have the duty to govern their organizations, like that, you know? But there was a time that I thought about it, and I thought, what a statement, you know? And I was very blessed, and to me, he's very alive, you know? He's very alive. I cannot talk about him dead. Because on the other hand, I believe that nobody dies. You know, life is eternal. Well, sometimes in Christianity, they tell you that you must do this and that so you can be saved, you mm-hmm. know? And that's the end of life when you die. You are not incarnate anymore. You are not in this body. But it's a spirit that's living in this body. It's not this body who has a spirit.
Uh-huh.
Yeah, that's where we get all confused when we think that we are bodies that have a soul or a spirit. But we are a spirit having an experience as incarnate beings.
Wow. So returning to the El Salvador issue, there are probably a lot of people who don't really know what happened in El Salvador, why there was a war. Could you just say briefly what the situation was and how the Archbishop Romero, what his position was with respect to that, so why he was killed?
Why he was assassinated. Well, you know, this is a story that is long and old. I mean, the story of my country is the story of everybody's country, in a sense, you know, all of Latin America, all of the Caribbean, all of Africa, all of Asia, and many of the countries in Europe even have that kind of story, not necessarily as country, but as nations, you know, where people are imposed on, you know. Colonialism is a means of saying, you are a means by which we get what you are. You live for us. Women are colonized too.
Mm-hmm.
We live for the other. In the colonies, there is the center and there is the others that live in the periphery. And all this life is in favor of this one. All that you do, regardless, even the rich here, are upset. Because they are rich, because this one's allowed them to be rich, but they owe it to this, you know? And so this poet said that we have 14 provinces. You know, my country's small, so we call them departments. And then we have 14 volcanoes, which is true. The volcanoes are beautiful, they are majestic, and sometimes they erupt. And we had one that was active. And he said, and we have 14 families who are oligarchs. We have a little bit more than 14 families, but they accumulated everything by force. If somebody is really very, very, very rich, as people say, filthy rich, mm-hmm. it's been because he has exploited one way or another. It has taken from where it belongs to others. So at home, they were filthy rich. They wouldn't even want to go to the cathedral. They have their own chapels. And the archbishop before Monsignor used to have to go to bless anything that they needed blessing, you know? And their coffee plantations, uh-huh. or cotton plantations, and sugar plantations. Do you think that people can eat sugar and cotton and coffee and really be nourished and live a meaningful life? Uh-huh. They can't. So there is all this resentment for 500 years, and every time there were all uh-huh. these people fighting.
The very land that could have been used to grow food was all being used to grow cash crops for mm-hmm. export.
Mm-hmm. mm-hmm.
And then they probably didn't pay the people enough to make up for that with imports either.
Exactly. Yes. Uh-huh. But my country, you know, those rich people didn't care because they were also in cahoots with the military, who was created to support that. So all this is what creates the kind of situation that people just got very angry. The prices of everything goes high. And so anytime that they ask for higher salaries, they say, you're communist. If you form a co-op, you're communist. So, you know, the military increased. And as the military increased, the repression and the oppression got higher. And so the only thing that people could think about is, we're going to start doing kidnappings. But then instead of using the money, for example, to go and feed anybody, in a sense they said, if we feed these people with the money we have, that money is going to be off. But if we buy guns to fight mm-hmm. with these ones, and so it created all those conditions, and that's how mm-hmm. it is. The other thing is that then if people get together, and we can start dismantling that in another way also, but you've got to really work at love and forgiveness and understanding, learning to work together instead of, you know, for example, at home, there are not a lot of public telephones, but any public telephone there was, they had a sign. If you see anything that is suspicious, call this. So, for example, I get in an argument with you, and since we have all this fear and anger and resentment, you know, we don't distinguish uh-huh. the same anger that I have pent up in here. I get it against you, who are my coworker. Uh-huh. So then, you know, there were people that started to call that they saw something suspicious in there, and the military were just coming in.
People were being just slaughtered and left in ditches. I mean, this was the scandal of El Salvador that started to make people in the United States aware.
What we did is that, you see, the military were not able to exist without the U.S. involvement.
Yeah, and you can hear from their ideology that they had bought into this, you know, two worlds, communist and free.
See, it's very, very practical, you know, because then you get a lot of money to fight communism. And who's going to say how many bullets you really fired? How many grenades? They even were selling those weapons in the streets.
Uh-huh. Wow.
And that came out in the United States.
So they were also arming their own opposition, in a sense.
Yes, because, you know, the more they use and the more dangerous, the more they need it. But on the other hand, the opposition didn't have to be any longer going across borders to get it. They could buy it right there, cheaper than in the United States.
Wow. But, okay, well, you represented another method of approach, presumably.
Well, we were working in creating what we call dialogue for negotiated solutions.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to create the people with whom you can have dialogue. Mm-hmm. But the military were not willing. They didn't feel that they needed to talk, at least to listen. Least to negotiate, and the rich forget it, you know? And they felt very powerful, and they had their own bodyguards and all that. Mm-hmm. Sometimes people in the military were in the military, and the spare time they were also bodyguards. There was all this money related to military. But in spite of all, you know, the willingness, the needs of the people to live created a lot of conditions, and enough conditions that we could find ways of creating this dialogue. What happens is that, you know, like, suppose that you belong to an organization, like, say, to the teachers' union,
mm-hmm.
and somebody else, I belong, say, to the co-ops, and these other people belong to the church. So we would talk, you know, I would say, for example, or you might say, well, we better talk with the co-ops, they are going through the same mess. Mm-hmm. So you send a message, and then we agree that we are going to meet somewhere, and then you make a proposal to me. Look, I see that this is happening to you, and you even have numbers. And then you say, and this is happening to us in the teachers' union, and I see that to the students and to the university this is happening. What I think that we should do is that we should get all those people together and then we make them a proposal. And we believe that we should make a big, wide, you know, rainbow process of all the living forces in the country to take a position and have a unity march against repression.
Wow.
But you cannot announce it and come to this meeting, you know. Mm-hmm. All that has to be underground. So I agree with you. And I say, yeah, I agree with you. So we make a formal agreement of what we are going to do. So then we see all the other forces that we are going to go and talk. And so you start talking with some, and I start talking with some, and then we form commissions, and then, like, that's how it works. And at the end, you kind of develop a coordinating committee. That coordinating committee continues to work and then send information, and it goes like that. So, for example, these were my friends. Mm-hmm. They were having a meeting, and they came, and they captured them. And what they were accused of doing is that they were conspiring for dialogue and negotiation for peace.
Conspiring for dialogue and negotiation.
Yeah,
for peace.
Because they say, what are you talking about? Because that's recognition that there is another force than the military force.
Uh-huh.
And they were saying, those people, they are just terrorists. And so if you're talking about dialogue and negotiation, it's because you believe you are giving them force. And those people, where their bodies appear tortured and like that, you know. Uh-huh. And I belong to a process that was about 300 people, you know. That was about 300 that I kind of related. And it's only about 12, 15 people that we're really leaving.
Out of all those 300, almost everybody else was killed.
Killed or disappeared or who knows. It was very difficult. But I try to be very careful. And I always choose life, you know. I say, I choose to live. Mm. I don't want to be a martyr. Every time, even when Monsignor died, I had a talk with Monsignor, you know, already dead Monsignor, out of this body, right?
Uh-huh.
Yeah, I talked with him because I needed to take care of living people here on Earth. And I told him, I don't have time to be talking right now. You see all these refugees I have to work with. But I want to tell you one thing. I don't want to be like you. I don't want to be a martyr. I want to become, someday I want to be an old woman telling stories, not only about what happened and all the great things that we did together, but about what life can be and should be and we can make it be. And I just want to be able to make history, not to be in history, but to make history, you know, and for that I need to be alive here on Earth.
Uh-huh.
And so, you know, I was very careful. You have to know how to move. But it didn't guarantee it either. So I was also ready to die. You know, when you embrace life like that, you can die. But you say, but I chose this, and it's okay with me, and I love my life.
Yes. Well, negotiations finally did come in El Salvador.
Yes, in 92, finally we signed the agreements for peace, and that is good. But, you know, people were saying, after the agreements were signed, it was better when we had the war.
Oh.
For many reasons. One is that a lot of money was coming in to help, and that can get people very confused in all sides, you know. A lot of the people that were sustaining the war, you know, including the military, they saw that the money wasn't going to be coming through, and the U.S. needed that war to stop there because NAFTA was coming. You couldn't have NAFTA and free trade if, you know, who's going to buy?
Yes.
You can have the commercial wars, which is a different
commercial wars.
Yes. Uh-huh. But you cannot have the commercial war if you're having conventional war. So, you know, even the U.S. finally came about. But the spirit's moving. I see that it's the spirit moving. I don't care what other people say, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So the agreements were important because officially the shooting stopped. But the problem is that, you know, you had thousands of people that had been trained to kill, to be military.
Yeah.
That had been their life. They didn't know any jobs. They had to figure out how to teach people to become civilized, civilian now, you know, civil. But they didn't have the time.
Yeah.
So they didn't do it. So all these people had guns, grenades. So young men that were in the military that were very young had now gone back to their communities, but they go, you know, I am tough guy. And so they get drunk, and then somebody's having a party. So they want to go into the party. No, but you weren't invited, you know, but you cannot say that. But the people just didn't talk with them, or, ah, you're not talking with me. And they want to dance with that particular young woman, and the young woman didn't want, they throw a grenade in there. And then 17 people, you know.
So they learned nothing about problem solving, about social
interaction. No, especially in the military, you don't.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Maybe in the FMLN some, because they were about dialogue and negotiation.
And it was also an army with both genders in.
Yeah. Well, after a while, the military in El Salvador started to include some women in some things too. But basically, the military were not teaching people how to talk, how to listen. Shoot first, because you don't know if that's the enemy. And it creates those conditions and those situations. So right now, there's still a lot of violence, very, very hard violence. It's terrible violence. And economically, the commercial wars and all that is happening with NAFTA. NAFTA is supposed to be just for three countries.
North American Free Trade Agreement.
Yes.
Right. But it's North America, which is Mexico, United States, and Canada.
And it's very important, you know, because all those other countries live in the periphery.
In Central America.
Yeah. And they need to be part of this process for money, for commerce. That's not necessarily for the quality of life of people and planet there. You know, they have to figure out how else to do. But in order to be in the globalized economy, you got to be part. So all those governments in Central America are fighting to get accepted. The only other country outside Central America that has been accepted already is Chile, into the North American Free Trade Agreement.
Well, that's very odd.
Well, but that's because Pinochet had been putting everything in order there so that it can qualify to produce at the levels that they want for export.
Mm-hmm.
You have big kiwi plantations in Chile, or peach, and pears, and apples, and grapes. That doesn't necessarily go and benefit the people there. But my country and Guatemala and all of them, they are trying to fit into this new economy. You see, in order for NAFTA to exist properly, you got to make a lot of profits. In order to make a lot of profits, you got to make all those countries produce and be part of that globalized system. So you have structural adjustment programs, you know? Structure is that is already within the system. Adjustment, cut. It's just like all the cuts that you have here. You have structural adjustment programs here,
yes,
except that they don't tell you.
Yes.
Who imposes that in our countries is the International Monetary Fund that is basically led by the industrialized nations. The industrialized nations is what we call developed nations, but that's not development. You see, when you have to suck the life of others to live, that is not development. And so, are there any other possibilities? Yes, you can create them. You can choose, for example, to start working in a way right there, forming community. You start resolving the problems that you have together. You start tapping on each other's resources. For example, people from the countryside going to visit the National University and talking with the people from the agriculture department and telling them, these are the problems that we are facing. Mm-hmm. Can you come and visit us so you can give us advice on what to do in terms of our crops, in terms of our conditions, in terms of whatever they are facing?
So trying to get the people in the university with their minds and their resources and their skills to cooperate on helping the people at the grassroots level.
Uh-huh. But instead of them being there in the university and saying, oh, maybe we should go there and help those poor people because they are so poor and we'll feel sorry for them. It is the exercise of your power and going and knocking on the doors and saying, I have good news for you. You are a big resource and you can be very enabling to us. And then there is the House of Culture, there is the bookstore, there is the library. You go and influence all that. And then you start creating your own reality. It doesn't mean that you get off completely, but you start developing sustainability. You start learning all your medicinal plants again. You start learning how to keep healthy living, but you don't do it alone. You have to do it in community. And so this is governance.
Mm-hmm.
Governance is about governing ourselves. And from there emanates how to have a government. So we, if we practice governance, we will be able to tell the others what we want when they are in those positions to represent us and work for us. Those who are in government are supposed to be working for us. We elect them, or those jobs are in service to us. And you see, but you got to do it down here. And so we do conflict transformation.
Conflict transformation.
Yes. Anything that is supposed to be a problem is a conflict. So we figure out together how to make it an opportunity for growth and transform it, because it has a solution. Either you let it be and then resolve itself and it takes you away with it, or you transform it and make it work for you. So those kinds of things I'm doing, which is sustainability. And only when we create community and we govern ourselves, we participate in governance, then we create a sustainable process. It's not sustainable development, because development, they are talking commerce and a lot of money.
Yeah.
They're saying, how can we make a lot of money still without running risk fiscally or destroying the planet. No, sustainability is that we are the sustenance from where the solutions come. Emotionally, spiritually, physically, everything. We are the ones. We are the answers. We are the key to quality of life. It means we are the ones that create the riches. We are the power. Mm-hmm. So we exercise power, you know, in a very loving way. So we learn to choose love. To have sustainable peace, which is durable peace, we work on sustainability, the practice of sustainability.
Marta Benavides talked to me, Frieda Worden, on the Austin Community Television program Women's News Hour. The crew were Lisa Hayes, Suzette Cullen, and Gwen Williams. Audio was dubbed by Lisa Hayes at Water, Women's Access to Electronic Resources, and edited for Wings by Elaine Jacobs. You can email us, wings@wings.org. Wings receives staff support from the Foundation for a Compassionate Society. Our sound logo is from Libana's album, A Circle is Cast. This is the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Hello, I'm Eugene Rashad. Join me every Saturday from 2 p.m. to 5 p.m. for the best in jazz on your community radio station, KBOO 90.7 on your FM dial.
But I dig, and I know you dig, because I got 4 requests for this thing already today. Strutting right with it.
That was KBOO volunteer disc jockey George Page. Page has been playing jazz and popular black music on KBOO for the past 12 years.
What I do to the audience I draw, hopefully, is to please them with all types of black music. Mostly what you can't hear as a rule on larger black-oriented stations in L.A. or San Francisco. I play a lot of blues and a lot of jazz. All of it's black-oriented, but it's not the cuts you're going to hear on the other jazz shows. It's not the cuts you're going to hear on other stations, because other stations just don't play jazz and blues in a black vein the way I do here.
KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the SJAC Holiday Fundraiser and Open Hours Launch Party on Sunday, December 29th from 6 to 9 p.m. at the Social Justice Action Center in Portland. The Social Justice Action Center provides community space, access to a commercial kitchen, and now new open hours. The launch party will provide information about new programs, opportunities to volunteer,